Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. Why my fascination with chronic pain? So many people have it. Pain is often silent, hidden, personal, universal, misunderstood, devastating, mysterious, sapping, infuriating, inexplicable, unique, varied. Wow, just scratching the surface with that and piercing the heart. Managing pain draws on almost everything we know about managing life well at a time when we can't manage a thing. On the other hand, when successful, pain management to live life can be most satisfying. Poetic, isn't it? My series on pain management collects personal stories, mine and others, people with pain, clinicians, partners, academics, activists, device makers, and more. Today I'm joined by Jessica DeFrank. Dr. DeFrank conducts behavioral and health services research for various studies funded by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, PCORI, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC, and the American Cancer Society. Her areas of interest include health decision-making, measurement of patient-reported outcomes and attitudes, and evaluation of health promotion programs with a focus on cancer, screening, prescription drugs, and vaccination. Dr. DeFrank has also worked extensively in the area of communicating scientific information to lay audiences and leads an experimental study testing recommended practices for communicating uncertainty about prescription drug risks. In addition to her work in prescription drugs, Dr. DeFrank has extensive experience working in cancer-related decision-making, psycho-oncology, and survivorship issues. Jessica DeFrank, thanks for joining me today. I really appreciate it. I think we met at this RTI gig. You work for RTI. I'm a consultant on a gig, and we've had some communication around how a patient-facing pain app looks. Mm-hmm. And we've had some conversation about usability, and I think we both said, so what, and we might have used different words. Please introduce yourself.
Sure, I'm happy to. My name is Jessica DeFrank, and as you mentioned, I work at RTI International at the Center for Communication Science. We are a large nonprofit organization, and our mission is to improve the human condition. So I am a behavioral scientist at RTI, and in brief, I study how patients make decisions about their health.
When I was looking to get more information about you before this call, the first thing I saw that you are working on an INSPIRE trial.
So INSPIRE is a clinical trial, actually a pragmatic clinical trial that is led here at RTI.
And you're going to define what a pragmatic clinical trial is, because I bet most people won't know.
That's a good idea. So I'll describe first what a regular randomized clinical trial is, and then okay. That will help give some context to what a pragmatic trial looks like. So in a randomized clinical trial for whatever intervention or drug that you may be studying, patients are randomized to two or more different study conditions. And their outcomes are assessed. And usually these conditions are very tightly controlled. So that means that we don't want to see a lot of outside influences if we can. And we just make sure that everybody that's randomized to that condition is getting the exact same thing under, to the extent we can control it, the exact same conditions. So that way we keep everything as similar and equal as we can so that we know if we see any differences between these two conditions, it was in fact due to what's being tested rather than something else. So that's how a randomized controlled trial works. It has the word controlled in it. That is in contrast to a pragmatic trial. So what a pragmatic randomized trial does is it wants to know how these different interventions work, but in real world conditions. So we're not trying to control all these different outside source forces, etc. We are just wanting to know what happens in the real world. It's more challenging in some ways to run this type of trial, but I think the information you get is potentially more valuable from an implementation standpoint.
Okay, thank you. So you were describing that INSPIRE is a pragmatic study.
Yep, it's a pragmatic study, and it's being tested at three different clinical sites, one at the University of North Carolina, Vanderbilt University, and Duke Medical Center. So it's being conducted in real-world scenarios.
And it's studying what?
It's testing two different strategies to help patients manage their chronic pain. So these are patients who are already on opioids and are on a high dose of opioids, and it's testing two different strategies to help them better manage their pain with the ultimate hope that they may want to consider tapering or reducing their reliance on their opioids.
Okay. So this issue of managing chronic pain, it seems in the patient caregiver circles that I travel in, whenever people talk about opioids and managing opioid use, what's clear, it's really about managing chronic pain, and that opioids are one method, and it's often a focus because it's considered such high risk and problematic, but that the focus of starting with opioids rather than with chronic pain doesn't work so well for patients. In terms of managing chronic pain, there's so many factors, meaning that a person's life and the limitations on their life. There's the clinician, and there's the relationship with the clinician and the skill of the clinician, and there's questions of access to non-medication solutions or other medication solutions other than narcotics. When you're looking at that and you're thinking about the decision-making process, how do all those other factors work into your study?
That's a wonderful question. And like you said, decisions around medication are multifaceted. There are a lot of pieces that go into that decision. One of the conditions, the study arms that we're testing as part of the INSPIRE trial, is called shared decision-making. Shared decision-making is simply a two-way conversation between clinicians and patients where they're exchanging information about how to best manage the pain. And it goes deeper than just facts about risks and benefits of opioids versus another technique. But what they want to know, and potentially more importantly, are what are the patient's preferences and their values and their concerns and their goals. And so this is a much more in-depth conversation. So for example, a patient may say, I value my family, I value my grandchildren and being able to see them and lift them up and put them in my lap. And with this pain, I'm no longer able to do that. So my goal is to be able to lift my grandchildren and have them in my arms. It just allows the clinician and the patient to have a better exchange about what their goals are and what they really want to get out of this. And then they may say, for example, I have tried this medication, but my preference is to not be on medication. I would rather try another approach. So then they start talking about these types of preferences. Yeah, so it's this exchange of information between the clinician and patient that goes beyond just simple facts.
So when you're doing this study, is technology included, or is this is about the relationship and the conversation? How does that
come into play? I have two answers for that question. I'll answer it first prior to COVID and then post-COVID, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The intent with shared decision-making is to, aside from this conversation that patients and clinicians are having, it's good to somehow prepare the patient for these conversations so that they can come in prepared and educated and with a list of questions. And so as part of this intervention, patients would receive a packet of information either through email or like a hard copy of a packet to study. And it actually included in one of the packets that we give patients electronically is a link to a video, and it's called the car with 4 flat tires. And it's mm-hmm. a really simple video released by the American Pain Association that mm-hmm. just talks about strategies to pain management and how there's usually no one single strategy. And so it's similar to a car with 4 tires. You need to work mm-hmm. on all 4. So anyway, so technology comes into play. There is the way we share information and educate our patients.
Okay.
To answer the other question.
Well, wait a minute. Hold off ahead. Before you go to COVID.
Yeah.
So it's always interesting to me that often the conversation is about educating patients. Mm-hmm. And I think a relationship is 2 people or more than 2 people. And so it's interesting to me that it's not often the conversation about educating the other part of the relationship, which is the clinician. Mm-hmm. And so how does that work its way into this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. From our study's perspective, physicians who are part of this INSPIRE study have been trained to engage in shared decision making. So this is a shared decision making clearly goes outside of our study, and this is a technique that several clinicians have been trained in. So there is an education component for them is to learn how to have those conversations, how to probe and what it looks like. And I remember at one point in the early stages of the study, someone spoke up and said, isn't this what clinicians do anyway? I mean, don't they just naturally have these conversations? And that may not always be the case. Sometimes these conversations could be a little more one-sided or prescriptive, mm-hmm. but these are tested techniques to exchange information so that it truly feels like a more of a shared decision-making model.
Okay. And so the part of the physician end of it is learning about the life and the situation of the patient that they're working with so that they're I had a conversation with David Edwards recently, and generally these are not his words, but that he has different buckets where he thinks about people. There's the people who are, look, just tell me what to do. You're the expert. Tell me what to do. Then there's people who are, look, I know what I want, and your job is to help me get what I want. Then there's people who are just not necessarily comfortable being in this relationship. And I think there were more buckets, but so now my words is I think there's as much variation in clinicians as there are in patients. And so that the permutation of the two, and we'll talk about caregivers later, which then is a whole nother permutation on the dilemma. All right, you were going to talk about now COVID.
So you had asked about technology, and what immediately came to mind is how healthcare had to pivot during COVID to an online platform, and that affected our study as well, of course.
Oh.
And so, for example, what happened with INSPIRE is that, of course, these shared decision-making visits were happening in a clinical context. The patient would go in for their normal visit and engage in this conversation with their clinician. But then as clinics were pivoting to telehealth, Inspire had to do the same. So our concern was, can a clinician and patient still have these sensitive conversations about their pain and their preference and their values? And can they still be done effectively over the phone or over the internet? Or are we going to be losing something in that transition? Are these conversations best reserved or best done in person? What we found, fortunately, is that the conversations went just fine. They felt that telehealth was an asset, and they were absolutely able to still maintain rapport with their patients and have these types of conversations. That doesn't mean to say this telehealth can replace in-person medicine, but it was an acceptable option, and we don't feel like it had a negative effect on the study in any way. The second arm of our study is something called, it's group therapy. It's group cognitive behavioral therapy. So these are group sessions led by a moderator where they share techniques for managing pain in a group setting. One of our largest challenges with the Inspire study had to do with these group sessions. Some people didn't want to enroll in the study because they knew they couldn't come to these group sessions every week for 8 weeks. So that was the requirement. You come for eight sessions. And just because of distance or just transportation issues or time, they just could not make that commitment. But with the transition to telehealth, we had to put these sessions on a virtual platform. And again, we had the same concerns. Will everyone have internet access? Will they even want to do a group session online? Will they feel comfortable having their face on a screen? Will they be engaged, or will they be checked out? And so we're looking into this right now. So I don't have any data to offer, but what we're finding is that a lot of patients said they even prefer this telemedicine model for the group sessions because they can now be there, whereas before they had a lot of difficulty making these sessions. So it can reach some patients who are maybe more geographically isolated or have other transportation barriers. What we don't know is who these technologies leave out. So are there certain patients that have been left out? And we don't have an answer to that yet, but it's certainly something we want to look at. And of course, the concern is that we already know that there's disparity in the type of access to healthcare. So we just don't know if telehealth is widening that disparity and widening that gap or closing it. So that's or both, right?
Yeah, so. Depending on who. Yeah. I know when I worked at Boston Children's, I used to, when I had like spare minutes, I would go into the lobby and just sort of sit myself on the floor off to the side and watch the kids go by. And seeing parents with five kids, two or more, let's say, they're there for one child who is there for some treatment, but they're going with all of their kids or all of their kids that aren't in school, or what did I know about what the sum total of kids was? I didn't know. But they had a bunch of kids in tow. And I thought, oh my goodness, now here's an access challenge. Now these are the ones that could make it and drag their kids along. And I'm assuming that for the most part, they were for multiple visits. This wasn't a one-off. They had to do this often. What seems like barriers are so varied, and technology probably helps with some and creates others. But technology isn't just the video or the phone. It's also about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. So there are apps that support CBT. Is that part of what you're doing, or is yours more live, whether it's virtual or not?
All right. So for the Inspire study, this is live. It was intended to be a group setting intentionally because there's some benefit to being in a group and sharing experiences and stories. Yeah, this did not rely on an app, but I am aware or did hear that there are some apps out there for people that want to do this more on an individual setting.
Yes. Okay. What other kinds of technology have you found people are using as they're managing their chronic pain?
I'll speak to that first about the technologies we're using in the Inspire study, and then I can shift to pain as I think about that a little bit more. But so as part of Inspire, of course, we want to collect information from patients in the form of surveys about their pain and how its intensity and how it's interfered with their lives. And so this is important information for us to look at to know how these two different strategies are working and if there's one that seems to outperform another. So anyway, back in the day, we would usually administer these surveys using a paper survey and participants fill in those bubbles and, and they're mailing them back. And sometimes we get them back. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes you're not sure what bubble they filled in. There are all kinds of limitations to that. And with technology has just made data collection so much easier. So for example, when patients enrolled in our study, they would enroll in person at the clinic, we would hand them a tablet and the survey was loaded onto that tablet. And we said, okay, take 15 minutes and just click your responses. And then it's automatically, you know, uploaded into our database. So that streamlined a lot of effort for us. And then the other nice thing too is now that most patients have access to email, I want to say over 80, maybe even close to 90% of the participants in Inspire gave us a working email address. We can administer these surveys online and send them a link. And then they have a link that's just meant for them. It's linked to their email address, so it cannot be forwarded to somebody else. And they can fill out these surveys for us right there. And we've had very few problems as far as technology or glitches with those. So it helps us increase our data collection numbers. And then patients can easily come back and do their next survey because they know it's not a heavy lift.
Now a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Abridge to record your doctor visit. Push the big pink button and record the conversation. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com. ABRIDGE.com. Or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Let me know how it went.
Okay, now step aside from the study. And so corollary learning that you've done yourself as you've observed the process, do you see that there are other technologies that people are using as they're trying to manage their pain? I had mentioned the one, the portal. I guess some people I've heard say they use a meditation app.
Yeah, I haven't heard too much about that, but I do know that in the CBT arm, that's exactly what they're doing, is trying to teach patients strategies for managing their pain that are not reliant on opioids. And part of those strategies are sleep strategies or meditation strategies or breathing strategies. I don't know if the therapist recommends specific apps for them, but that is one place a lot of patients turn to. There are a large number of apps out there that can, for either low cost or free, that can guide patients through some of these activities. And they may not necessarily be marketed for pain, but they're for, you know, a number of different conditions.
How do you think that you're wildly successful with this Inspire and you get not only that A is more likely than B to be effective for this population under these circumstances, but there's a large group of people that's true for, and nothing is ever everybody. How do you, as a scientist, how do you think about what happens after the study?
No, that is an excellent question and something I think we all struggle with a little bit in science. And I'll give a few answers to that. So first, when we are designing a research study and thinking about our proposal, we do design it thinking with future dissemination in mind. So we try to use that lens. We would not want to recommend a study that could not in any way be disseminated in any form later. That just would not be practical or feasible.
Okay, now dissemination means that you do a study, you write a report, you have some results, and you share those results widely. So narrowly would be at academic journals and conferences, and widely would be beyond that for our purposes. So that's what you mean by dissemination, or is it also you're thinking about implementation so that people are actually using it and doing it?
Right. So absolutely. Implementation. So okay. That's probably a better word for that. Yes, we want it to be implemented and those strategies to also be disseminated. So okay. We want to be sure not only can the study be implemented here in this condition at RTI and Duke and UNC and Vanderbilt where we're doing it, but it could also be packaged in a way that could be taken off the shelf and used somewhere else.
Yeah, like rural West Virginia or
exactly
someplace that's not an academic medical center.
Exactly.
Okay. So that must be some of the art of designing a study, because you want to go where the expertise and the patients are in some volume where you can have a significant sample size. And often where it's implemented, there's much less of a volume. I've never been in that position of trying to think about how is it going to be used in rural West Virginia. And I say rural West Virginia because I lived in rural West Virginia. And sometimes I read these funding applications and I think, oh my goodness, we could never do this.
You know, I'm from rural West Virginia as well. So
are you really? Yes, isn't that a riot?
It is.
I lived in Weston, West Virginia.
Weston, wow, okay, coal mining.
No, it's a gas and wood.
Gas, oh gosh, okay.
It was near Clarksburg.
Yep, okay. Gosh, yeah. I can't say I've been to Weston, but
okay, yes.
Wow. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a consideration. I can't say the results of the study can be, you know, implemented without change in a more rural environment. Clearly, things would have to be adapted. But if we learn, for example, from Inspire that shared decision-making is a very powerful tool and it was very successful in helping patients taper, then there's no reason why clinicians who treat pain patients in West Virginia in the rural areas can't learn shared decision making, especially since there are now, we're getting back to technology, a lot of online training courses for physicians.
When I'm wearing my preventative and chronic health management hat, is I think that people have varying tolerance for risk. And that's really acute now with COVID because people come to me often and they want my advice about something. And I feel like, who the hell am I to give them advice? And so usually the conversation I have with them is about their tolerance for risk. And I feel well able to have those kinds of conversations, because I think that as both as a nurse and as a person with chronic illness myself, I feel like I am constantly thinking about relative risk. So an example for me is that my greatest risk is falling, but another is not to walk. Okay. And so those are risks that are in constant tension, because the more I walk, the more likely I am to fall. But if I don't walk, I won't keep up my strength, which is an important thing. Anyway, so when people are in chronic pain and they're involved in this relationship with their clinicians, of this shared decision-making, informed decision-making, whatever, there's this understanding of relative risk. And it's not just the relative risk of the patient, but it's the relative risk of the clinician. And so for the clinician, it may be how much time do they want to spend or can they spend, given their productivity pressures or the scrutiny that they might have of their prescribing habits. And for patients, it's, as you were saying, I want to hang out with my grandkids and do whatever with my grandkids. But what does it take to be able to do that in terms of the amount of pain I have, my fogginess from having that pain or treating that pain? So how does this risk tolerance end? Mm-hmm. To this, or not, if yes, how?
Absolutely. So we know that patients' perceptions of risk are very strong drivers of the decisions they ultimately make. And that's been shown in the literature time and again. But how do patients weigh risk is a very good question. So I think you're speaking about risk of, for example, risk of action and inaction. So you're referring to, the risk if I act, here's the risk if I do exercise, there's a risk of falling or injury, but there's also a risk of inaction. So if I don't exercise, there are certain benefits that I'm losing. So that loss of a benefit is in itself a risk. Patients are weighing these benefits and risks. And some other ways they think about two things, and they're not always aware that they're thinking about these things, but what typically goes through their minds is first the likelihood of that risk. So how likely is it would I be to fall versus how likely would it be for me to experience something negative from not exercising?
Okay.
So you're looking at the likelihood. Mm-hmm. Of each outcome. And then also the seriousness or severity of that outcome. If I were to fall, how bad would that be? What's the level of badness? Right. If I fall, am I going to break a hip? Or are we talking about just an uncomfortable fall versus the severity of not exercising? So if a patient says, if I don't exercise, I know that's bad for my heart and I have a heart condition and I need to be sure to get physical activity, it could be a very serious risk mm-hmm. to not exercise and get that cardiovascular benefit. So this is the type of weighing that's going on in patients' minds. Yeah. I don't think patients always sit down and write down the pros and cons of this decision,
just
this unconscious calculation that's going on.
But then it seems like a really good collaborative relationship is trying to ferret that out with the clinician. Like I know for me with my primary care doc and my neurologist, one of the things that I do not want to risk is that I'm a pathologically optimistic person and I don't want to do something that's going to mess with that. And so that's like a risk too far. So if they want to prescribe something for me that might affect that, I'm more likely to say no. And they know that about me. So that's part of the conversation in terms of the pros and cons. I was reading about you to prepare. And it seems like that your work was in cancer care before, right? Okay. My wife had breast cancer. And I know that we were thinking a lot about these percentages of risk. Mm-hmm. And so it just seems like, on the one hand, all that seems like really similar. This idea of risk, they have different in whether it's cancer care or me, I have MS, or if it's chronic pain, the conversations are similar. Mm-hmm. But in your experience, as you've moved along from studying cancer care to studying chronic pain to life, so are there unique risk thinking depending on the domain you're in, or are there just common threads?
That's a great question. I'm going to answer this from just my gut rather than a scientific perspective, but
I think
the way patients think about risk, there are some ways that they think about risk that apply across any context you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, some contexts are a little more emotionally charged than others. So the way you would think about cancer diagnosis and the numbers around that have a lot more emotion than something about the risk of something more mild, right? That it would not be life-threatening. Mm-hmm. But I think to answer your question, as a whole, there are some kind of best practices in thinking and communicating with risk that apply across the board.
Okay, so tell us about two of them.
Yeah, sure. First of all, you mentioned cancer, and so that brings to mind some of the earlier work I had done when I was working in that field. I think the first place where patients have some difficulty understanding and we have difficulty communicating to patients is what that number means. So if you are told you have a 5% chance of your cancer recurring, that does not mean that you as a patient, your personal chance is 5%. This is a population level number.
Yeah.
And because of your personal history or age or other factors, your actual number could be well above that or below that. But again, so I think there's some difficulty to communicating to patients. This is the population level chance of this recurring, but that doesn't mean we don't know what yours is, though.
And 5% could freak me out, not bother my wife at all.
Exactly. People interpret the same number in different ways, and we've found that in studies. So if you ask a patient, if you say this cancer has a 5% chance of recurring, and you ask them how large that feels, some patients will say that feels very small, and I'm not worried. And some will say that feels very large, and I'm very worried. So there's a lot of varied interpretation in those numbers. The same is applies to if you give the patient a range. So if you say, okay, your chance is between 5 and 10, patients don't know where are they going to fall on that range. And we tend to be optimistic as human beings and have called optimism bias. We want to say those things happen to other people, but not to me personally. So I'm probably closer to the 5% and not the 10%. And it's just a natural bias we have.
Yeah. What a fraught conversation. And today, with COVID, this is just this risk on steroids. People who feel like, oh, this has never happened to me. I don't know anybody who's gotten it, and I'm not worried about this. And then there's somebody's mother died, and they're really freaked out. So exactly. The sense of risk, so there's personal experience.
Right.
So with cancer, my mom had cancer, so now that's a little more real to me. God. But it's just none of it is simple. Okay, so let's shift a little bit for a minute. And we've been talking about this with shared decision-making with sort of a dyad of a patient and a clinician. And in many people's lives, there's way more people involved in that. There is either a designated care partner or there's a whole family. And in my experience as a nurse, you are never just treating the patient. Never. Almost never. In a way, it was sad if you were just treating the patient because that felt really lonely. Mm-hmm. But then you're adding this dimension. So I guess I have a couple of questions about that. So how does that figure into the study, this added dimension of more people and that influence?
Now, that's a great question, and unfortunately, that's not something that we've been able to address with the INSPIRE study, but certainly something that we acknowledged early on, that pain and management, or whether it be another condition or cancer or whatever, it is often, it's not involving one person, it's involving the entire family. And so the well-being of the patient can influence the well-being of the caregiver and vice versa. So it truly is a dyad. There's literature in the pain world that suggests that having that social support from a caregiver, whether it be a spouse or somebody else, can greatly enhance their ability to manage pain. Having that person to, you know, help take you to appointments or stay on top of your medicines or remind you to do certain exercises that you haven't done or to motivate you to do them can really be beneficial. But you know, yeah, unfortunately, it's not a component we could look at with Inspire, but it's certainly important.
And then probably the flip side of that is maybe having my wife be my care partner really helps me out, but it could also be very wearing to her. And so then she's more at risk for other things because she's putting so much energy into the best life for me.
Absolutely. And that's been documented a lot in the cancer literature, is that the caregivers have been a neglected population in the literature and in healthcare for a while. But we do know that the caregivers suffer enormous distress. They're carrying the burden of their loved one, but they also need to take care of themselves. So that's something that we're now addressing, and there are different types of support now for caregivers and a recognition that they need some extra help.
Now you've been researching all these different things, and I know when I sent you a question, I said if you could be king for a day, and I said something about a policy or practice, but I guess I don't want to limit that. You're a thoughtful scientist and you're a family person. As you learning in this shared decision making, communication and health sphere, if you could wave your magic wand and change something, what would it be that you think would really have an impact in the well-being of either patients or clinicians or caregivers? So I'm asking you a very subjective question.
No, that's fine. Yes, I would love a magic wand for a day. I think so. The thing that bothers me the most, and that I think our magic wand could address, would be disparities in access to the types of care that we're talking about. For example, we just talked about how Inspire is being done in a large academic institution. About those patients in rural West Virginia that don't have access to these large medical centers, that are relying more on these very small underfunded community centers that may not have access to technology or not be aware of these apps. And I'm concerned that there are so many segments of the population being left behind on all of the advances and science that we are generating. That's a difficult question to know. How do you address that? And technology can come into play here. But yeah, I would love to see a lot more energy placed on how can we make sure these disparity gaps are lessening rather than widening as we learn more in the research world.
Thank you for that answer. So what should I be asking you that I'm not?
Oh my goodness. How about what's next after Inspire? So what do we plan to do with that?
Okay.
The Inspire trial still has several years to go, but the hope is that we'll find that one or both of these strategies turns out to be very effective for helping patients manage their pain. So the next step, and we already talked a little bit about this, is, okay, what do we do with that information? How can we get it into practice? Mm-hmm. One thing that we've talked about is because of COVID, like I mentioned, we had to pivot to these online virtual group sessions for the CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. And from what we can tell, patients have been very receptive to that. And the therapists running the sessions have been very receptive to it. And this was not something that we were planning to do at the outset of the study, is to offer this online. So just, you could say this kind of has been a natural experiment. All of a sudden, we're looking at how technology can enhance this type of intervention. So what I would love to do, if you were on the PCORI board and deciding what grants got went through and what didn't, I think I would love to have an opportunity to take these findings and adapt them for a virtual or online setting so that they can reach more patients. And there has been, that is a growing body of research, but at least in CBT for pain management, we have not seen anything like this done yet. So that would be really cool, I think, is to see what happens if we take this to telehealth.
Wonderful. Thank you, Jessica. I appreciate it.
You have a good weekend.
Take care.
Bye.
We talked about the difference between a randomized control and pragmatic study, studying strategies for tapering off high doses of opioids, technology pre and post COVID, turning research into action, risk tolerance and informed decision making, and families. Turning research into action and risk tolerance feel most important to me. Research without action is ink on paper, worthless to non-academics, patients, caregivers, communities, and clinicians. Risk tolerance provides context for informed choices. In COVID world, people living paycheck to paycheck with few income-generating options in general tolerate more infection risks than people with many options and money in the bank. I didn't ask Jessica about patient caregiver engagement in the Inspire research, strategy operations, analysis, and dissemination processes. I should have. Thanks for reading or listening. Onward. See the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.